The following presentation is brought to you by Faith Presbyterian Church Reformed. Delivering today's message will be Dr. Richard Bacon.
Thou wouldst open our hearts that we might receive that wisdom. Not only that we might understand what is the difficulty and the problems in this present life that Solomon so clearly points out, but that we might also begin to understand what he says is the solution, that we might see what he says we ought to do, how it's possible, even with the bitterness and the sourness of this life, that we might compare to a sour lemon, that nevertheless there is a way of approaching this life in such a way as to bring glory unto Thee and satisfaction to ourselves. And I pray that Thou wouldst teach us such from Thy Word. For I ask this in Jesus Christ's name. Amen. Let's read chapter 9 of the book of Ecclesiastes. And I don't want us to be here for an inordinately long time, but I do want to try to cover the entire chapter because of the manner in which the chapter is written. Well, you'll see what I mean by that when we get to my outline of the chapter. For all this I considered in my heart, even to declare all this, that the righteous and the wise and their works are in the hand of God. No man knoweth either love or hatred by all that is before them. All things come alike to all. There is one event to the righteous and to the wicked, to the good and to the clean, to the good and to the clean and to the unclean, to him that sacrificeth and to him that sacrificeth not. As is the good, so is the sinner, and he that sweareth as he that feareth an oath. There is an evil among all things that are done under the sun, that there is one event unto all. Yea, also the heart of the sons of men is full of evil, and madness is in their heart while they live, and after that they go to the dead. For to him that is joined to all the living there is hope. For a living dog is better than a dead lion. For the living know that they shall die, but the dead know not anything, neither have they any more a reward, for the memory of them is forgotten. Also their love and their hatred and their envy is now perished, neither have they any more a portion forever in anything that is done under the sun. Go thy way, eat thy bread with joy, and drink thy wine with a merry heart, for God now accepteth thy works. Let thy garments be always white, and let thy head lack no ointment. Live joyfully with the wife whom thou lovest all the days of the life of thy vanity, which he hath given thee under the sun, all the days of thy vanity. For that is thy portion in this life, and in thy labor which thou takest under the sun. Whatsoever thy hand findeth to do, do it with thy might. For there is no work, nor device, nor knowledge, nor wisdom in the grave, whither thou goest. I returned, and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, neither yet bread to the wise, nor yet riches to men of understanding, nor yet favor to men of skill, but time and chance happeneth to them all. For man also knoweth not his time, as the fishes that are taken in an evil net, and as the birds that are caught in the snare. So are the sons of men snared in an evil time, when it falleth suddenly upon them. This wisdom have I seen also under the sun, and it seemed great unto me. There was a little city, and few men within it. And there came a great king against it, and besieged it, and built great bulwarks against it. Now, there was found in it a poor wise man, and he by his wisdom delivered the city. Yet no man remembered that same poor man. Then said I, wisdom is better than strength. Nevertheless, the poor man's wisdom is despised, and his words are not heard. The words of wise men are heard in quiet more than the cry of him that ruleth among fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroyeth much good. May the Lord add his blessing to the reading of his word. You know, Koheleth has a way, the preacher has a way, of putting his finger on things, doesn't he? Have you ever noticed, perhaps this hasn't happened to you, but you have a friend who's kind of down the dumps. They could use some cheering up. And so you go over to cheer them up, or you call them on the telephone to cheer them up. And by the time the conversation is over, you're in the dumps right along with them. Well, sometimes that's the way I feel about Kohelet. He kind of convinces me to be down. Story is told. I apologize for this if it was him. It may have been Billy Graham who told the story about a fellow who was standing up on the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco about to jump and yelling that life was terrible, life was terrible. The police chief sent a policeman up to talk him down. And he said, "Tell me what's the matter?" And he began to tell him. 10 minutes later, they both jumped. That's kind of the way Kohelet affects you sometimes. He points out all the things that are wrong about life. And so what I'd like for us to do is look at the first part of the passage under consideration and the last part together, as though they were one unit, because they're really saying the same thing. And in between, there's an interlude that gives us, if you want to say it, his solution to the human condition. So in verses 1 through 6 and in 12 through 16, if we consider what Kohelet tells us about life, we might call that portion or those portions how to crack up. But if we look at the intermediate portion, verses 7 through 10, we might say that there Kohelet is telling us how to bear up. First then, how to crack up. He says there are two things that he's noticed about life. And while everything he talks about fits under those two, it is two basic things: life and death. The uncertainty of life seems to bother him considerably, and just as much as the uncertainty of life bothers him, the certainty of death bothers him. Notice, for example, that he says in verse 1 that tomorrow is unknown. He says, "I considered in my heart, even to declare all this, that the righteous and the wise and their works are in the hand of God. No man knoweth either love or hatred by all that is before him." He doesn't know what's going to happen. We've seen that happen on a large scale in this country. It would have been impossible for most of us to predict, I would say all of us, to predict at the end of the Gulf War that within 18 months we'd have a new president, because the Americans would have voted out of office a man who had the highest approval rating in years and years and years of any president. It would have been impossible, probably in 1986 or 87, I forget the exact year, for any of us to have predicted. How many of you remember who Len Bias was? He played basketball for the University of Maryland and signed, maybe one of you can tell me what pro team it was that signed him in the NBA. But which one? The Celtics. So big team, elite team in the NBA, signed him. $600,000, $750,000, whatever it was, signing bonus. Excellent player. Athletic man. Strong, burly, huge man. He went to Boston, signed the contract with the Celtics, went back to the University of Maryland, and within a month's time, died of a heart attack. Who could have predicted? How could he have foreseen what was going to happen to him? Kohelet notices that and says, "We don't know what's before us. It's in the hand of God, but we don't know. Whatever's before us is unknown to us. There is no knowing tomorrow." And here's the thing that bothers us about that. It bothers Kohelet and it bothers us, whether we care to admit it or articulate it or not. And when we don't know something, we can't control it, right? It doesn't really bother us that we don't know tomorrow. What bothers us is that we have no control over tomorrow. Our life is not really in our own hands, but rather in the hands of God. So the first thing about the uncertainty in life is this: tomorrow or the future is unknown. The second thing that bothers him about this present life is that it cannot be safeguarded. In verse 2, he says, "All things come alike to all. There is one event to the righteous and to the wicked, to the good and to the clean and to the unclean, to him that sacrificeth and to him that sacrificeth not. As is the good, so is the sinner, he that sweareth as he that feareth an oath." And then look at verse 12. "For man also knoweth not his time, as the fishes that are taken in an evil net, as the birds that are caught in the snare, so are the sons of men snared in an evil time when it falleth suddenly upon them." It doesn't make any difference whether you're a Christian or not, does it? How many of you have ever noticed that as a Christian you can walk down the street without an umbrella, and although it's raining on everyone around you, it's perfectly dry where you are? No, it doesn't happen that way, does it? It rains on the just and the unjust. The fact of it is, what befalls the wicked also befalls the righteous. God has not put a different set of laws into the universe to govern the way it rains on the just. What Koheleth is saying here is that the things good and bad that happen to the just happen also to the unjust. And the things good and bad that happen to the unjust happen also to the just. The net doesn't care, does it? The net's just out there gathering up fish. The snare is just out there gathering up birds. It doesn't care. It's going for all the birds it can get. And the things that happen to us in this life, it's not as though they were directed at us by some cosmic force out there, or it's not as though we were protected by something of that nature. Rather, when things happen to good people and they happen to bad people. They happen to religious people, they happen to irreligious people. They happen to pious people and they happen to the impious as well. And Koheleth says, how can I make sense of that? I believe things are in the hands of God, and yet I see no advantage to the righteous in this life. Life is too uncertain for that. The third thing he sees, if you look at verse 11, back up a little bit from 12, he says, success cannot be guaranteed. And here again, we might be reminded of Len Bias, or who's the quarterback for the Cowboys, Troy Aikman, who now is going to have to undergo back surgery, it seems, and may be out for a season or perhaps for the rest of his life. In verse 11, Koheleth says, "I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, neither yet bread to the wise, nor yet riches to men of understanding, nor yet favor to men of skill, but time and chance happeneth to them all." When we watch the Olympics once every 4 years, is it the case that the fastest runner in the whole wide world happens to be there on that day and win the race? Not necessarily. If he happened to receive the right training from the right people at the right time, then yes, he may be the one. But there's no guarantee of that. Life has no guarantees. The race is not always to the swiftest. Some of you have watched the movie Chariots of Fire. And you may recall that although the hero, Eric Liddell, was the fastest man in a particular race, that in the course of the race, someone nudged him illegally, and he fell down, and although he got up and ran and proved himself to be the swiftest in the race, he didn't win, did he? Not in that particular race. The race isn't always to the swiftest. Again, Koheleth notices this. He says, what's going on here? It just seems like the swiftest man ought to win the race. It seems like the strongest army ought to win the battle. But that's not always the case, is it? How many of you have seen the movie Henry V? Now, I might also mention to you that that's another of my favorite films. At the Battle of Agincourt, did Henry have the largest army? No. Henry had a tiny little army compared to the French. And yet, while just a handful of the English army was killed, tens of thousands of the French were killed on the battle. Why? Because the battle is not always to the strong. Neither is bread always to the wise. The wise man doesn't necessarily always make the best living, does he? Nor the man of understanding become always rich. Nor are skillful men, artisans, always the ones who receive the greatest favor. Why is that? Does that seem unjust? Well, Koheleth is pointing to something here, and he's indicating that he thinks it's unjust. He thinks that the swiftest person ought always to win the race. The strongest army ought always to win the battle. That there ought to be some consistency in life. And yet he has noticed that success can't be guaranteed, whether it's to the athlete, to the army, to the laborer, to the professor at the university, whether it's to the scientific discovery or whatever. What that person calls success, that is winning the race, winning the battle, is not always guaranteed to the best one there. And then one final thing that he notices about the uncertainties of this life is that people really can't be trusted to choose the best part. And he says that in verses 13 through 16 by telling us a little story. He says, "This wisdom have I seen also under the sun, and it seemed great to me. There was a village and a few men within it." He's probably talking about something much smaller than the city of Rowlett, but it did have a wall around it. "And there came a great king against it and besieged it and built great bulwarks against it. Now there was found in it a poor wise man, and he by his wisdom delivered the city." Now in the English we have it to where it's just real obvious that the city was delivered by his hand. Okay, in the Hebrew there's some more uncertainty there. It's more like the idea of he could have delivered the city. "Yet no man remembered that same poor man. Then said I, wisdom is better than strength. Nevertheless, the poor man's wisdom is despised, and his words are not heard." Now here's an example of what he's been talking about, that the race is not always to the swift. What we have here in the case of this wise man, whether he did deliver the city and then people forgot all about him, or whether he could have delivered the city and the men just forgot to ask. In either case, they didn't go to him, not because they didn't think he was wise, but because he was poor. They just forgot that he was around. Or they may have said, "If he's so wise, why ain't he rich? If he knows so much." But whatever the reason, they despised his wisdom, not because he wasn't wise, but because he wasn't rich. They refused to remember him when they should have, in either event. Either out of gratitude, because he did deliver the city, or in going to him to find out how to deliver the city. You know, sometimes people's behavior is characterized by that animal who, when you try to feed him, instead of taking the food from your hand, what does he do? He bites you. It's called biting the hand that feeds you, right? And sometimes people exhibit that same kind of behavior. And so it becomes a cliche in English. He bit the hand that feeds him. And that's kind of what the elders of this city did. The poor wise man could have or did deliver the city, and yet they showed no gratitude. They did not give him the recognition that was due to him. And so, what are some of the common uncertainties of this life that Koheleth sees? Well, the fact that tomorrow is unknown, that life can't be safeguarded, that success can't be guaranteed, and that people just can't be trusted to do the right thing. Well, that's enough to depress you. It's enough to depress me. But that's not all. There's more, and that is that there's a common destiny in the next life. Look at verse 3. He tells us, first of all, that death is all-embracing. There is an evil among all things that are done under the sun, that there is one event unto all. Yea, also the heart of the sons of men is full of evil, and madness is in their heart while they live, and after that they go to the dead. I was reading some health information. I've been doing a lot more reading about health lately. I was reading some health information, and a person made the absurd statement that taking a particular drug reduced death from all causes by 35%. Well, no, it didn't. I've got some news. The mortality rate among human beings is 100%. You cannot reduce the death rate from all causes. You may be able to switch the cause and say, well, people no longer die of whooping cough, but those same ones that would have died of whooping cough now die of heart disease or cancer or some other consumptive disease. But nevertheless, they will die. And so that's just absurd. But it's the way people think. People really do think or act or live as though they're going to live forever. They really do talk about reducing the death rate. Well, how can the death rate be reduced? Now think about it. That would mean that some percentage of people aren't going to die. But people make absurd statements like that. You know why? Because they've never really come to grips with death. They don't see it as the all-encompassing thing, the all-embracing thing that it really is. The author of Hebrews tells us that it's appointed unto men once to die. Do you know why men die? Because it's appointed. Men will die. And I say that not referring to males, but referring to all humanity. Every last human being will die. Stalin is reported to have said, regarding who is going to win World War II, Stalin is reported to have said, in the end, only death is the winner. Lord Keynes, when it was being explained to him that his economic system couldn't possibly work in the long run, answered, yes, but in the long run, we're all dead. The children's rhyme, I don't know if you all knew this or not, but the children's rhyme that says, ring around the rosy, a pocket full of posy, at you, we all fall down, is actually about the plague of the 14th century. And they're right. In the end, we all fall down. In the end, we all die. Well, Kohelet, Solomon, doesn't take that as simply a statement of fact. He recognizes it for what it is. It's an evil. This is a terrible thing. We should not run away from death, but neither should we embrace death as though it were our friend. Death is the enemy. In fact, Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 that it's the last enemy that Christ will overcome at the end of time, doesn't he? But it is the enemy. It is evil. Once again, in verse 3, of Ecclesiastes chapter 9. There is an evil among all things that are done under the sun, that to one event unto all, yea, to the heart of the sons of men is full of evil, and madness is in their heart while they live, and after that they go to the dead. So what is it that they go to the dead? Or they all go to the dead? It's an evil. There is an evil among all things that are done under the sun. Now, we were talking about the absurdity of reducing the death rate by 35% from all causes, which simply cannot be done. But just as absurd as that is a behavior in which a country like the United States, a rich country, spends literally billions and billions of dollars every year out of the private sector, that is to say, out of men's and women's pocketbooks, each year in order to stave off death for a few days, for a few months. Not that they're paying these billions of dollars in order to have a full life, in order to have an abundant life, just to have a longer life, just a few days longer, as though they could bribe death. If you'll just take my money, let me stay. But they too go. They go poorer, and they go having wasted their children's inheritance, but they go. Billions. And finally, he tells us in verses 5 and 6, well, 4 through 6, "For to him that is joined to all the living there is hope. For a living dog is better than a dead lion. For the living know that they shall die, but the dead know not anything. Neither have they any more a reward, for the memory of them is forgotten. Also their love and their hatred and their envy is now perished. Neither have they any more a portion forever in anything that's done under the sun." Now this is a common Old Testament view of the afterlife. What does he say the afterlife is like? It's pretty much like nothing. It's pretty much like non-existence in a way. There's no memory. It's just a shadow world. There's no more a portion. They don't know anything. They don't have any kind of reward. Their passions are gone. Even their evil passions like envy are gone. They have no passions. They have no desires. So he says, what's it like? It's kind of like nothing. Thus, he concludes, and he gives us his conclusion first, where there's life, there's hope. See in verse 4, him that's joined to all the living, there's still hope, for a living dog is better than a dead lion. Now we need to understand that in the Israeli culture of this day, a dog was just an unclean creature. He's not this cute little puppy dog that you have at home that you nurture and feed dog food to. That's not what he's talking about. He's talking about a cur out in the street that has no redeeming social value whatsoever. But for that creature, living is better than being the noblest of creatures, the king of the jungle, the lion, but dead. Because at least the dog is a live dog. The lion, as noble as his name might be, is dead. And so, the living, no matter how poor their existence might be, no matter how unfair life might seem to them, the fact of it is, as long as they're alive, there is some hope. And that is why people spend the billions of dollars a year that they do to stay alive for a few more days, for another week or two, for a couple more months, for another year. Why? Because they also recognize, desperately recognize, that where there's life, there's some hope. Well, that's how to crack up. Is just consider two things, life and death. Well, then how do we bear up? Well, we bear up, this is where you have to kind of look at the sermon title a little bit and try to figure out, if what we've had so far is sour and bitter, then the way we bear up is by squeezing lemons, by taking that sour fruit and squeezing. How hard do we squeeze? Well, that's what Kohelet tells us in verses 7 through 10. Materialism doesn't help. He's told us that already, hasn't he? Several times in the book. In fact, it really only heightens the absurdity of death. To accumulate, build wealth, build an empire, and then die. It's absurd. Materialism is absurd in light of death. Nor is the answer hedonism. He talked about having wives, and he talked about the sensual aspects of life. It too simply heightens the absurdity of death. But there is an answer. And we have our first glimmer of it, really, in the book of Ecclesiastes, right here in these four verses, verses 7 through 10. The answer is, live life to the fullest while you have life. What do you do with a lemon? You squeeze it. How hard do you squeeze it? Well, whatsoever thy hand findeth to do, do with all thy might. How hard do you squeeze it? Hard as you can. He tells us in verse 7 to enjoy contentment, in verse 8 to enjoy comfort, in verse 9 to enjoy companionship, and in verse 10 to enjoy confidence. You see how that was supposed to be made more memorable to you? There's four C's there. And the reason that they're all C's is so that you'll remember this. That's a mnemonic aid. First of all, then in verse 7, enjoy contentment. He says, go thy way, eat thy bread with joy, drink thy wine with a merry heart, for God now accepteth thy works. You see, he's telling us that food and wine are basic gifts of God. He said that before, hasn't he? And he'll say it again. What do we need before we can begin enjoying life? You tell me. You tell me what we need before we can begin enjoying life, and I'll tell you what's keeping you from having a good time. Do we need to leave home? Is that it? We just have to leave home. Then we can start having a life. Or maybe when we start college, then we can really find contentment when we go to college. Or maybe it's our new job. Maybe it's getting married. Maybe it's a new home. Maybe it's when our children finally get grown and leave the nest. Listen, you tell me what you're waiting for to start life, and I'll tell you what's keeping you from being content. The fact of it is, your life starts now. Your life's already going. It's already started. Don't wait. Today is a gift from God. Take whatever God has given you, the food, the wine, the simple, basic things of life, and begin using them. Have a merry heart. Be content with what you have. Paul's secret was not in having a lot, was it? Paul's secret was in whatever state he found himself, whether it was abundance or whether it was poverty, to be content. Wasn't that the secret? The secret's not in what you have. The secret's not in how much you have. And the secret's not in waiting for something that you may or may not ever have. After all, life is uncertain. Isn't that what... Children, help me out. Wasn't that what Charlotte told Wilbur? Is that a spider's life is uncertain at best? Well, that's true of us as well. Our life is uncertain at best. And so take what we have. Take what God has given you, the gifts God has given you, and the resources God has given you, and make the most of them. Enjoy them. Use them with pleasure. Use them to be merry. Have a merry heart, for God now accepts your works. Then in verse 8, he says, enjoy comfort. Let thy garments be always white, and let thy head lack no ointment. Now, this may not be real clear to those of us who haven't used New Fab, but because we think of white clothes as being just something hard to keep clean. But in the desert, think about a desert climate now. Think about where you're going to have the sun shining on you all day. Why would you have white garments? Because it reflects the heat. You can remain cooler if you have white garments. And so when he says have white garments, he's saying be comfortable. Anoint your head with oil. We might say today, take a bubble bath. Relax. Anoint your head with oil. Let your garments be white. Put ointment. Now this is not selfish pleasure seeking. This does not mean just live for the day, take all the pleasure you can and so forth. But we also need to understand that there is no real relationship between asceticism and holiness. That going out and sitting in the desert on top of a platform does not make us more holy. God has given us the good things of this life richly to enjoy and to make ourselves comfortable. So we should not be ashamed of comfort. In fact, when God does make us comfortable, we should use that as a tool whereby we can be reminded of the needs of others. But we also are accountable to God for the comforts God has given us. Now think about that for just a moment. That God has given us not only the talents and gifts that we enjoy for the subduing of the world, but He's also given us the comforts of this life to enjoy. And if we don't enjoy them, if we don't make use of them, then it really is a refusing of a gift of God. Imagine, if you would, that you've given me a gift. Something that you really wanted me to have, and something that if I used it, it would make me comfortable. But whenever you come over to visit me, I always have it stuck on a shelf up in the closet because it's never used. What would be your attitude toward giving me gifts? Well, he's not really grateful for the gifts I give him. He's not really willing to utilize the gifts I give him. Well, when God gives us things for our comfort in this life and we don't use them, don't you know that God will hold us accountable for that? Of course he will. So Kohelet says here, eat your bread with joy, drink your wine with a merry heart, but also be comfortable. Let your garments be always white. Let your head lack no ointment. Do things for yourself to bring about your comfort. Enjoy contentment, enjoy comfort, and then in verse 9, enjoy companionship. Live joyfully with the wife whom thou lovest all the days of the life of thy vanity. Now, I will admit, I would probably not invite Kohelet to preach my wedding. That's not the sort of thing that you want to hear, where he says, live joyfully with the wife whom thou lovest, and then proceeds to say, all the days of the life, it's just going to be a bunch of vain emptiness anyway. But he does tell us that marriage, while it's not a blissful cocoon, does provide us with some comfort in this life. It is something that God has given us as a gift. Now, the backdrop of a happy marriage continues to be this miserable life. He says, you're still going to have a life of vanity. Don't expect that marriage to change the way you live your life. Things are still going to happen to you just like they did before. It's still going to rain on you when you go outside without an umbrella. Nevertheless, the wife that he has given us, the spouse that he has given us, can bring us joy. We just need to remember that what the backdrop is. Don't concentrate on the backdrop to the exclusion of the foreground. The marriage is taking place in the foreground. And while there is misery in this life, and those of you who have been married for a while, think back to the early days of your marriage. There were hard times, weren't there? Some of the vanities of this life took place in your marriage, and yet you made it through. You had one another. You leaned upon one another. It wasn't the end of the world. While life was miserable in some respects, life was great in others. He just wants us to know that marriage is not the answer. It's not some cocoon that you wrap yourself up in and all your troubles go away. That there are still going to be problems, yet God's given us one another to lean on. God's given us a joyous or happy, or the possibility of a happy marriage. And then finally in verse 10, he tells us not only enjoy contentment, enjoy comfort, enjoy companionship, but also to enjoy confidence. He says, whatsoever thy hand findeth to do, do it with thy might. For there is no work, nor device, nor knowledge, nor wisdom in the grave where you're going. If you're going to do something, you know when you're going to have to do it? Before you die. There is a certain amount of urgency involved. You can't do the things that you're going to do, the labors that you're going to undertake, the devices, the knowledge, the wisdom that you want to gain. None of that's going to be available to you after you die. So you're going to have to do it now, and you're going to have to do it with energy, with skill. You're going to have to make your own opportunities, he's telling us here. You're going to have to use your talents. Now, although I've used the word confidence here in order to get another C, I don't want you to think of this as self-confidence. This is not as though we're thinking, oh, I have the power to do this. It's within the power of my hand. Remember, he started off by telling us that none of these things are in our hand, but in the hand of God, in verse 1. So while we should have confidence, it should not be a self-confidence, but rather a confidence that God has done all things right. The judge of all the earth will do right, and he gives us the ability Some of you know that I listen to Rush Limbaugh from time to time, and sometimes he refers to himself as having his talent on loan from God. You know, that really is the case, isn't it? Anything that we have from God. Every good gift and every perfect gift cometh down from the Father of lights, with whom is neither variableness nor shadow of turning. We do have our talent on loan from God. So the confidence that we have is not really confidence in ourselves, but confidence in what God has given us. Knowledge that things are indeed in the hands of God. Now, let's take the parable that Jesus told about the talents. He said that one man had five talents, another man had two talents, another man had one talent. You remember the man who had five talents invested his five and made five more. The man who had, does it matter how he did it? Not at this point. That's not what the parable's about. It doesn't matter how he did it. He invested it. He did something good. And he got a return. Then the man with two talents, he did the same thing, didn't he? He invested, and he doubled his money. Now, the man with one talent, he scratched his head and said, you know, that guy is a real hard taskmaster. So I'm going to bury my talent. I'm going to wrap it up in a handkerchief and bury it. Well, then the king came back, or the person who gave the talents came back. And to the person who had five talents, what did he say? You done good. You done? Because you had five, you invested those five, you made five more, you're a good steward. Then he went to the fellow that had two. What did he say? The same thing. He said, you had two, you made two, you doubled my money, I'm real pleased. Then he went to the fellow with the one talent. Now, he didn't berate him, did he, for having only one talent. What did he berate him for? For not investing it. For not doing with it what he could do. For not having a return. Now, God has given us gifts and talents. God has given us things that we can invest in this present life. We can scratch our head like the fellow with just the one talent and say, you know, I've read here what Kohelet says, and there's just an awful lot of uncertainty in this life. And we can bury it in the sand and forget about it until the king returns. Or we can go ahead and invest it and get the best return we can possibly get. And that's what Kohelet tells us to do here in verse 10. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. Do it hard. Do it fast. Do it strong. Do it well. Do it the best you know how to do it. Don't hide it in the sand. Now, we've already been accepted in Christ. Verse 7, we're told, go thy way, eat thy bread with joy, and drink thy wine with a merry heart, for God now accepteth thy works. You see, our labor is not in vain in the Lord. It may seem to us, as we look about and see the vicissitudes, the changeabilities, the things going topsy-turvy, the upside-downness of this present life under the sun on this earth, as we see these things, it may seem to us that things are out of control. But Kohelet tells us, no, they're in the hand of God. It may seem to us that our works, if they fail, will be unacceptable to God. He tells us here in verse 7, no, they're acceptable to God. Your works have been accepted. Not because of what we've done, not because of some good thing in us, but they've been accepted in Christ. They've been accepted for who Christ is. So, squeezing lemons. Well, yes, life sometimes can be sour. And how do we squeeze life? Well, Kohelet tells us, doesn't he? We squeeze it with all our might. We do what we can do the best we can do it. Let's pray. Father, we thank Thee that Thou hast indeed accepted our works as they are presented unto Thee through Christ Jesus. That it's not success in this life, but rather success in the next that ought to concern us. And yet, all that we do, our devices, our knowledge, our wisdom, our work, cannot be done as we lie in the grave, but must be done in this present life. And so we ask of Thee, teach us, grant to us wisdom and knowledge and understanding in this life. Grant to us diligence encourage, that we might do all that Thou hast called us to do. And we praise Thee that Thou hast given to us, even in this uncertain life in which things happen to the unjust as well as to the just, bad things befall that man who sacrifices as well as him who sacrifices not, that Thou hast nevertheless granted to us the possibility of contentment and comfort and companionship and confidence. So we praise Thee, for Thou hast done for us that which we could not do for ourselves. Now as we finish this day which Thou hast given us to set to sharpen and whet our axes against the stone of Thy word, I pray that Thou wouldst grant to us that Thy word might sink down deep, that we might take advantage of what we have heard, what we have sung, that Thy Spirit will apply it to our lives in such a way that we might be more fully conformed to the image of Thy dear Son, in whom we have been accepted and in whom our works are accepted as well. For I pray in His name. Amen.